Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What are the true origins of yoga, and can it really do for us all the things its most devoted practitioners promise? Although yoga has indeed been around for centuries, its modern form dates only to the early 20th century, and even since then it has evolved in remarkable ways and spread throughout the world among people seeking everything from strength and flexibility to weight loss to better relationships. As a student of yoga since 1970, William J. Broad is convinced it creates a lot of quantifiable benefits for those who do it regularly. But as the award-winning senior science writer for the New York Times, he is also committed to separating the myths of yoga from the realities so that devotees can make good choices about the role it might play in their lives. His new book is called The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. Bill, welcome to THINK.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
The history of yoga might surprise people who think of it as having emerged chiefly as a spiritual practice. Can you tell us about its earliest roots?
Yeah, this was one of the big surprises for me as I researched this topic. It turns out that Hatha yoga, the kind that everybody practices now around the globe, started out as a branch of Tantra, which is and was a sex-related cult. Tantra rites and rituals were often symbolic, but there were also times when people would go out there and do things physically by way of sexual stimulation. And eventually Tantra and Hatha had a very bad image in Indian society because people felt people were engaging in all kinds of unseemly acts as a pretext for some sort of spiritual enlightenment.
Hmm. And in fact, modern science bears out that yoga has benefits as a tool for improving people's enjoyment of sex. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, especially on Valentine's Day. Right? So it was one of the hardest parts of the book for me to research, but it turned out that the stuff is there. You look at one report after another, and it stirs hormones. It cooks up brain waves that are indistinguishable from those of lovers in the midst of sexual rapture. They've now done studies of fast breathing showing that it's sexually arousing, a beautiful set of studies done at the University of British Columbia. And there's even recently been a study in India among more than 100 men and women who took up yoga, and they reported across the board improvements in desire, arousal, orgasm, overall satisfaction. I mean, it gets, you know, down to the nitty-gritty here, right? Better erections, confidence. Women felt more emotional closeness with partners. So it seems like the science strongly reinforces the idea that yoga can be kind of sexually uplifting.
Is this something that people who are not strangers to a yoga mat or a yoga studio say, well, yeah? I mean, is this something that doesn't take people who do yoga by surprise at all?
I'd say it's a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. People who do it, I think, understand it. And it's just that the scientific world, the literature is muddied. And people who looked into it, I think, got confused. And so it's a little bit mixed in the science and in the yoga literature. But there's clearly a vein now, especially there's this neo-tantra, and there's a lot of sexuality in yoga. You know, positions and all kinds of, detail that you can find out there. So in this case, it's the science looking at what might have been a myth and finding out that it's true.
So when did the first modern scientific study of yoga begin? It was like the 1920s?
No, way back. 1851 was actually the first, and it was done by a guy who nailed some stuff about respiratory physiology that yogis often still get wrong.
Hmm.
It didn't go really strong until, the 1920s, when this guy named Gune, south of Bombay, founded an ashram that did nothing but study the science of yoga and had dozens of people working for him and looked at this stuff very hard for the first time. That was really the founding of the experimental science of yoga.
And did that raise the global profile as these studies started to be published?
it did something even more profound in a way. It helped transform yoga. If you scratch a yogi and say, well, what does science have to do with yoga? The response would probably be nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that that movement in the 20s profoundly, and that scientific movement, helped reshape yoga. Yoga was reborn in the 20s and 30s. And what the reformers like Gounod did was try to get rid of these kind of mixed and bad associations with Tantra and recreate this new thing that was sanitized and uplifting, all about health and fitness. And that became the modern yoga that we have today. So it not only studied it, it changed it fundamentally into this practice that has taken the world by storm.
It's interesting also to hear about in the relatively recent history of yoga, but perhaps in the last century, that even in India, people who practiced yoga would sort of go from village to village and make money doing their poses. It wasn't necessarily something that the broader population engaged in all the time.
Right. No, it was usually one-on-one, teacher to student, and wasn't done in classes. I mean, all those things, so much of what we associate with yoga is modern, and it isn't perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's still evolving, and that was one of the big things that I stumbled upon, and part of this book was excerpted in the New York Times, and one of the fascinating reactions that I got from many people was that it's still in the midst of evolution. People are trying to make yoga better, which I found fascinating and applaud.
Well, let's talk about that, because there was this excerpt in the New York Times, and we will talk more about the benefits of yoga in a little while. But
sure.
Among some people, you've been known as the guy who's trying to kill yoga, which is absolutely not right, which is not the case.
No. I do yoga. I've done it forever, and I love yoga. I did it this morning. I did it yesterday morning. I'll do it tomorrow. God willing, and it's a fundamental, important part of my life. So I'm all for yoga and for yoga getting better. I don't want to bash it at all.
But you have personal experience with the fact that it is possible to be seriously injured doing this.
Ouch! It was just one of these horrible, nightmarish kind of experiences. This was right at the beginning of my book research in 2007. And I went to a class, and it was a teacher training class. There were a lot of advanced students there. There were a lot of women, and quite frankly, many of them were quite lovely, right? So here I am, a guy in there kind of, you know, pushing myself, strutting, going along, and we had broken into twos, and I was kind of talking to my partner and doing a hard stretch to the side, and my lower back gave out. Now, that's a weak part on my body, and I should have known about that. I should have thought closer about what I was doing, so I blame myself for this. But everything, you know, gave way. I couldn't see for the tears and the blinding pain in my lower back. My knees gave way. I hit a wall. I slumped down into a pile on the floor, and everybody in the room came over to see, you know, what happened to this poor journalist over there. It was humiliating, and it was embarrassing, and it took months for my lower back to get to iron out the injury.
I mentioned having read this book to some friends of mine who do yoga, and they said, well, sure, if you're doing it wrong. I mean, is that the only time there's a risk if somehow you are performing a pose incorrectly?
No. I would say that there are intrinsically dangerous things, and that was one of the big surprises in the book. There are poses that I will not do anymore based on the research that I uncovered. For instance, shoulder stand. You bend your neck about 90 degrees. And it turns out that there are these delicate little arteries that go through this bony labyrinth in your neck. They're called the vertebral arteries.
Mm-hmm.
Those get tweaked around while you're doing a shoulder stand, and you can tear the inner lining. And then you get clots there. And when you come out of the pose, the clots go to the brain, and next thing you know, you've got a stroke. That means part of your brain has been destroyed. That's you know, you don't usually associate sports injuries with actual brain damage and that kind of thing. It's on the spectrum of bad things that can happen to you while you exercise. That's right up there.
Yeah.
That's a serious injury. And there's other nerve and spinal things that are associated with yoga that make it, dicey in some respects, intrinsically dangerous.
Is there a competitive element in certain classes where if you're with a bunch of people who are really good, you want to make sure that your body does the same pose that their bodies do?
Yes, we do this to ourselves, and American culture has bred a lot of this stuff. You go to a Bikram class, you know, it's bodybuilding. They have mirrors on the sides of the rooms, mm-hmm. right, which just like you do in a gym. So you're looking to compare yourself to everybody else, and you're doing these cookie-cutter poses, right? I had this opposite experience with a really gifted guy named Glenn Black in New York City. None of it was cookie-cutter poses. All of it was based on what he saw we were doing and what we were able to do. It was all tailored and customized to the group of people he had in the room rather than, kind of this outward competitive agenda which happens in too many yoga classes.
How does yoga in the United States compare with what's being done in 2012 in other parts of the world?
You know, I don't know is the truth. I'm a great, great, you'll say with all humility, science journalist. In terms of cultural comparison, I don't know. But this I do know. Yoga is hot everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've gotten more calls and done more interviews with people in Brazil, Australia, Austria, Norway, Spain. It's just all over the place. It is a global phenomena. And the American brands are spreading. Bikram, which is some people refer to as McYoga, is spreading in Europe and Canada and other places. It's hot in more ways than one. This stuff is a planetary thing. And the figures, the estimates are astonishing. They say that, you know, 250 million people on this planet are doing yoga. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a big number, and it implies that this has achieved a huge currency around the globe.
And it's a really upscale demographic. In fact, I think the yoga demographic and the NPR demographic and perhaps the New York Times demographic are in some ways quite similar.
Right, right. They tend to be well-educated. They've got good jobs. They make high salaries. And I think, just judging on my own experience, it's because many of these people work stressful jobs.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I do for the New York Times is report on horrible apocalyptic, possibilities like germ weapons and nuclear weapons and all this stuff, right? It can be very tense. And I get away from my job, and yoga is a sure thing for helping me relax, for helping me de-stress, for helping me unplug and unwind. And I think, this is a hunch, right? I can't prove it, but I think that many, many of these high-stress professionals turn to yoga because it works to unwind them. And I think it's also why you tend to find a lot of yoga studios in some of the planet's most crowded, most tense, most urbanized, busy, stressful environments.
Hmm.
It's because it's the perfect counterpoint. It helps people deal with huge doses of urban stress.
Is that because of the concentration? Is it because of the breathing? I mean, obviously, there's a combination of factors.
Right, mm-hmm. It's a combination of factors. Breathing can be very important. But you also, and this is one of the paradoxes and one of the myth-busting parts of the book, everybody knows yoga does things for you on the outside, right? You can become more flexible, more agile. But it also, the science very strongly shows, and I talk about this a lot in the book, that it produces inner flexibility, physiological flexibility. And in fact, it makes your overall metabolism go down so that if you eat the same number of calories every day, you're liable to gain weight.
Well, we're going to want to talk more about that after the break, so let me have you pause here. My guest is William J. Broad. He's senior writer for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. Join our conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is science journalist William J. Broad. He's senior writer for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So, Bill, if there were TiVo for radio, there would be a lot of people saying, wait a minute. You just said that doing yoga can lower metabolism. Tell us about that.
Right. It produces this inner flexibility. So physiologically, overall, what happens, even if you do a really fast workout, what's happening in the long term is that you are burning fewer calories and your overall metabolism goes down. There have been some very beautiful studies that I point out in the book that show this effect. And that can contradict one of the main modern claims of yoga, which is that it zips up your metabolism so much that you automatically lose weight. The science says that is wrong. All things being equal, if you eat the same number of calories and start doing yoga, you will gain weight. It's mathematical. So that's one of the, you know, exploded myths that we come across as the science marches forward.
So how do you explain the fact that many people who are very committed to yoga tend to be quite slim?
Because there are other effects that come into play, mostly psychological.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, yoga is a discipline. Yoga builds up willpower. Yoga can bust stress eating cycles. Yoga can help you turn away from the refrigerator, right? When you're starting to feel like, oh, I could just use another whatever. So yoga can do all kinds of excellent things for you psychologically that will help you lose weight. But when that happens, it's despite what's going on with your physiology rather than because of it. This is a fundamental confusion that you see over and over and over in the yoga literature. Pick up a popular book. You see these phrases, revs up your metabolism. It's not true.
Hmm.
The science doesn't support those statements.
And one thing, as much as you do value yoga in your own life and think it can be helpful for a lot of people, you're frustrated by the yoga industry. Can you talk about what bothers you?
Well, simply that they have these big myths that they broadcast and they use it to lure in lots of students.
Mm-hmm.
The three biggies are that yoga is completely safe, yoga will automatically make you lose weight, and that yoga is the only exercise you need to stay fit. None of that's true.
You still need aerobic workouts.
The evidence, as I lay it out in Chapter 2, is real clear. No matter how many sun salutations you do, no matter how fast you do them, you just do not get that aerobic edge. You don't get the heart-pounding workout that you need for cardiovascular fitness to get this aerobic benefit that all the public health officials say it should be your number one health goal. So, people love to sell it. The yoga industrial complex loves to sell yoga as a one-stop shop that does everything for you. It's not.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the line now. We'll speak with Pasnim in Dallas. Hi, Pasnim.
Hello. I just wanted to ask, I used to love yoga as a younger person. I had a pretty serious car accident and have a back and neck injury that I'm fully ambulatory. But I've been very worried about doing yoga for, you know, harming myself again. I wanted to know if there are any adapted yogas for people who have back and neck injuries.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great question. In all honesty, I don't know the answer. But I do know that there are many, many sensitive people out there, smart people, who do yoga therapy. They tend to be unlicensed, right? There's no uniform national or even regional guidelines for yoga therapists, but there are smart individuals out there. I profile one of them in the book in Chapter 5, Healing. Mm-hmm. Martin Fishman on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. He's a genius. He's a medical doctor. He's a yogi. He does all kinds of yoga stuff for rehabilitation and therapy. For instance, he invented this procedure where you do a modified shoulder stand and he will cure your rotator cuff injury. It teaches muscle substitution so that you don't need surgery, right? So there can be remarkable rehabilitation that is done in yoga. The problem is that there's no structural professional organization that's making sure all these people that do this stuff are up to snuff. It's sort of the Wild West stage of yoga therapy.
So, Bill, what does it take to know we're in good hands with an instructor?
With an instructor, I'd say experience, 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 just like location, location, location in real estate. And that doesn't guarantee it, right? But it does give you more confidence. The green teachers who think everybody should be as flexible as I am, I think can be a terrible situation. Experienced teachers tend to know more about the variety of pupils that they'll have in the class and will stress people doing the postures to fit them rather than having postures fit the people. There are also styles that pride themselves on injury prevention. The younger people tend to have intense teacher training that lasts at least 2 years. They use blocks and props and blankets and all kinds of tricks to customize postures so that they fit the people rather than having the people try to fit the posture. So those things can be, you can look out for that kind of stuff. And also just starting with a gentle style. Bikram is very intense, can be very competitive. There are these, you know, bodybuilding, yoga fit, styles which can be quite stressful and gym-oriented. It's probably best to start with a gentle style and an experienced teacher.
And are we better off, generally speaking, at a dedicated yoga studio rather than, my gym is offering in between step class and something else, I can take
right.
yoga?
I don't know. I'm a great science reporter, and I don't know that much about the cultural diversity of yoga.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say it's hard to make generalizations, right? There can be geniuses all over the place, and there can also be charlatans in
right.
places you don't expect them. So the bottom line in the book, and that comes out clearly from my research, is that don't leave your brain at the door. Go in, wide-eyed and make your own evaluation. Don't assume that yoga is ancient and perfect. It's not. It can be bad, and you want to be watchful for bad aspects. If you feel that a pose isn't right, don't do it. Don't push yourself beyond your limits. Pay attention to those thresholds of pain. The whole book aims to empower people, to try to help people be their own best teacher and work the practice to their own advantage.
I was fascinated by what you discovered with regard to yoga's effect on human creativity.
Right. That was surprising to me, and I didn't come across it early in my research. It sort of came piecemeal toward the end. And the evidence is, quite frankly, not that strong scientifically. Some of it's anecdotal. There are some strong suggestions. But there is this phenomenon, you see it over and over, of yoga stirring creativity and yoga being an integral part of the lives of highly creative people. Now, why all that happens, I'm not sure, but you can see some aspects of it in the science. For instance, there's this one guy, one doctor in Philadelphia did a neurophysiology study. He found that yoga lights up your right brain, lots of different parts of the right brain. The right brain, as neuroscience tells us, is associated with creativity, spatial relationships, intuition, emotion, all these things that we associate with creativity. So maybe that's part of it. Maybe there's also the quieting effect that yoga can have on you, that unplugging, the relaxing effect, so that deeper thinking can bubble up into your conscious mind and you can, enter these more reflective states that are probably prone to creative thinking. So I think it happens on a lot of levels, and you see lots of anecdotal evidence all around. Just to give one example in my own life and career, the first person to write about this book was my colleague Maureen Dowd. She wrote about it back in October in a column in the New York Times. And she kind of came out of the closet. Maureen, it turns out, is a yoga practitioner. And it's one of the things that she does. She says it's the best thing that she's found for de-stressing and for coming up with an antidote to the craziness of her workday. Well, Maureen, I don't know if you read her, but she's widely regarded as one of the most creative journalists on the face of the planet. And I have a strong suspicion that yoga is not only helping her relax, but is helping her be the creative professional that she is and that she demonstrates over and over and over again in her columns. There's something fundamental going on here, and to me it's one of the sort of unknown bright sides of yoga.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. We're talking to William J. Broad about his new book, The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. Let's go back to the phone now. This time we have Jerry on the line in Louisville. Hello, Jerry.
Hello. This is Jerry.
Hi.
Hey, Jerry.
I wonder if you have run across the name of Dr. Moshe Feldenkrais.
I have not.
In that. In 1978-79, I spent some time with him, and he called his work Jewish Yoga.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows the body better than anyone I have ever experienced.
There are wonderful, knowledgeable people out there. It's amazing the breadth of knowledge that individuals have developed over the years about the body. And it's not all in these, the mass-marketed yoga stuff. A lot of times you find extremely talented individuals like that who are geniuses about the body. This Glenn Black guy that I studied with and that I profile in the book and in the Times magazine excerpt, was like that. He is a genius when it comes to anatomy and understanding the body and the limits. People just swear by him. He has billionaire clients, people that fly him around to different places in the world because he's so gifted with his hands, because he understands the body so well. So maybe that was like your guy, Jerry, somebody who is just an individual genius on this stuff.
Is your sense, Bill, that the benefits of yoga can be and ultimately will be entirely explained by science?
Ooh, deep, one of those deep philosophical questions. I am of the school that says science is fantastic. It is the preeminent path to truth in modern society, but it doesn't do everything. I think there's all parts of life and reality and the universe that science can't touch. So I don't think science is going to do the whole thing. Science is never going to explain spirituality. Science, I don't think, is ever going to explain higher realms of consciousness. So in that sense, I don't think science will explain everything that yoga can do and that yoga can achieve for humans. But I think we are just at the beginning of a revolution of having science do a lot of stuff to clarify what yoga can do and how yoga can be made better. That's the note I end on in the book, and I believe it heart and soul. We, 20 years out, I think, are going to have, or 20, 30 years out, who knows, we'll have yoga doctors, people who go through the equivalent of medical school but don't prescribe a pill. They prescribe breathing exercises or poses or combinations of the above to achieve dramatic effects of healing, of disease prevention, of all kinds of stuff. I think there are many good things in the pipeline.
And there is interesting research about the application of yoga to the problem of chronic pain.
All kinds of stuff. Yoga works. Yoga, and even simple yoga works. Like there are simple positions that are sexually arousing. The cobra pose, which every beginner knows, it turns out to be sexually arousing. Fast breathing, which every beginner does. They call it breath of fire. That can, if you do too much, you can hyperventilate and you can pass out. But it also is a painkiller. You can't do that and feel pain. Yoga can do all kinds of stuff, and it's a fascinating lever, right, that we can have for influencing our body and our mind. Many, many people know that. I think we're going to discover lots of new leverage from it as we march ahead.
We have an email here from Monique who asks, how frequently do you need to practice yoga to get the benefits?
There's a lot of divided opinion on that. I'm in the school that says a little bit every day is better than being a weekend warrior where you sit around all week in a chair in the office and develop weak gut muscles and weak back muscles and then go try to tie yourself into pretzel poses on the weekend. I think that's a prescription for all kinds of problems. My first teacher said do a little every day, and that's what I've been trying to do. But there are people who disagree. There are people who say it's better to have an aggressive workout 3 or 2 times a week and have days in between. It depends, too, on what your goal is. It's a little misleading to say yoga. There's actually many yogas out there, and some are more bodybuilding and if you do bodybuilding, you know, if you lift weights, they say it's better to, you know, have a day of weight training than take a day off. So it depends what kind of yoga you're doing and what you're trying to achieve. For the kind of middle of the road mediocre yoga that I do, I would say a little bit every day is the right way to go.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Tony in Dallas. Hi, Tony.
Yeah, I don't know if I missed part of the program. I don't know if you mentioned Pilates at all. You know, Joseph Pilates was a physical therapist who incorporated yoga into his system, and I just wondered if anything about that, and I'll take my answer on the air.
Okay. You know, the book doesn't look at Pilates, but you're right. There is a lot of overlap, especially on the core exercises, which are fabulous. I am a sufferer of a herniated disc. I've got an L4, L5 herniated disc, and yoga and Pilates-type maneuvers and core strengthening have become part of my exercise religion. I do it every day, do a little yoga every day, and do a little core stiffening to help me manage that injury. I've never had surgery. I don't have pain. And I like it that way. I do this every day. And Pilates can do a lot of excellent stuff. And people, we tend to sit at desks all the time, and we tend to get very flaccid abdominal and back muscles, so that these core exercises can be a wonderful, wonderful antidote to back problems.
And you said you do some every day, so I'm guessing this is not always in a studio. Sometimes it's at home, or maybe
No, it's always at home.
Okay.
I've gone around for research for the book. Well, when I first got into yoga, it was with various teachers,
mm-hmm.
and then decades of doing it on my own. But recently, in doing the research for the book, I've gone to a lot of studios. But otherwise, my routine is my own. I do it at home first thing in the morning.
William J. Broad is my guest. He's senior writer for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. We'll talk more in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can call in to 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is William J. Broad, senior writer for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or think@kera.org. Bill, another one of the myths that you challenge here and seek to help us understand fully is that of yoga giving your body extra oxygen. And in particular, you really take on a book ironically called Yoga for Dummies. Can you talk about what was in that book that doesn't actually reflect the science?
Well, it's not just Yoga for Dummies. It's lots of books that go on, and lots of teachers. You scratch them and they say, all this deep breathing does wonderful things for revitalization. And the way it happens is that you get more oxygen in your body and your brain. You hear about this over and over. You read about it in every book, including Yoga for Dummies. And it's wrong. The respiratory physiology, and this was one of the first things that I stumbled on way back, decades ago, when I started to realize that not everything in popular yoga was exactly copacetic with the scientific facts. It turns out that when you breathe fast or when you breathe slow, you don't change the oxygen levels in your body and your brain. What you do change is the carbon dioxide that you hold in or that you blow out. Now, that does have wide repercussions throughout your body and, in some cases, on oxygen retention. But it's not this direct mechanism that people talk about. in the yoga books. Yoga people are right in saying that breath is vitally important, but they're right for the wrong reason.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Daniel in Fort Worth. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, what's going on?
We're doing well, thank you.
I guess the host is back by popular demand. I heard him last week. It was great. Question, comment, do with it what you may, is what kind of roadblocks have you encountered by yoga and our American culture, by Christian fundamentalism that's scared of it?
Yeah, there's all kinds of people who are scared of it. It's like this foreign cult, right, that's over here trying to, corrupt the American ethic. So there's definitely a vein of that. But I don't know, yoga's being so laundered in American culture that it's really much more American than Hindu or anything that, you know, got exported into this country. Yoga is now as American as apple pie or anything else. Even Bikram, this wonderful entrepreneur who makes all kinds of unscientific claims and has these, you know, McYoga studios all around the country and the world. He's Indian, and he's from Calcutta, and he's more American than anybody. He's this just a rabid, wonderful entrepreneur with Texas-sized ambitions and is just going for it and has fleets of Rolls-Royces and Rolex collections, and why not? He's raking in money by the ton, and it's all American. So I'd say the Christian fundamentalists are worrying about the wrong stuff. In this case, it's really American.
We have an email here from Steve. Having talked about the risks, Steve wants to know if it's safe for children. He says, I have a 10-year-old daughter, and she takes a class offered at school.
The truth is, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there are studies that look at yoga with that fine resolution. You have to jump back a little bit and see what has gotten studied and why. Big pharmaceutical companies, for instance, are not sponsoring yoga studies. The federal government hasn't sponsored a lot of yoga studies. It's starting to now because it turns out to be important for prevention in some cases, disease prevention. But the science tends to be spotty. So what has been studied a lot are some of the more flamboyant claims, like yoga is the only exercise you need to do because it's so aerobic that you don't have to do, you know, jogging or swimming and that kind of stuff. Those things have been intensively studied. But things like, is yoga okay for kids? Haven't been, right? That's a marginal issue. So the honest answer is the science doesn't speak to it. I would say, just in a common sense sort of way, that gentle yoga couldn't be a bad thing, and that it would help introduce kids to notions of regular exercise, and exercise can be fun and that sort of stuff. But yoga, you know, can also be dangerous. So, you know, you'd want somebody smart doing this. You don't want to just rely on anybody, and you don't want to have those kids doing shoulder stands and headstands and things that could possibly hurt their spine.
In the same way that you'd be careful choosing a gymnastic studio or a
right,
soccer coach.
Exactly. Or, mm-hmm. Common sense goes a long way in yoga and lots of parts of life.
We have an email here from Indira who asks if you've come across studies showing the benefits of yoga for depression and addiction.
Yes. The evidence is extremely strong. And I had I was very fortunate to study with Amy Weintraub, who wrote a book called Yoga for Depression. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of the enormous benefits. You can see excellent science being done, and this has been funded by the federal government. And scientists at Harvard and Boston University have tracked how yoga unleashes neurotransmitters, chemicals in the brain that act as antidepressants, that lift your moods. And you can see that kind of effect in lots of other ways. Yoga fights depression. It works very well for that. I went to a class on mood management for women at Kripalu, this yoga place in the Berkshires of Massachusetts, and watched this talented Amy Weintraub woman teacher as she taught us all kinds of tricks for mood lifting. We all left that weekend seminar high as kites. There were more smiles and hugs and people feeling great than I've seen in a real long time. Yoga works to lift moods, and there are more and more studies. Amy actually has a book coming out, I think it's in April, about yoga in, I think it's depression and psychotherapy or something. There's more and more clinical evidence that it's a great mood lifter. And that's so important. A million people around the world commit suicide every year because they can't have any belief that there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel, that they can't see the optimism for the next day. So being able to fight depression and being able to fight these dark moods is a wonderful, wonderful tool to have. And yoga can deliver it to many, many individuals.
Let's go back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bill on the line in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Bill.
Hi. Great show. Really enjoying the discussion.
Thanks.
I'm an avid yoga practitioner, and I'm wondering how you would equate yoga with meditation. A lot of my instructors talk about it being meditation in motion.
I love that.
And,
yeah.
For me, that really works, and I'm wondering if it's a backdoor way of your talk about creativity and how there isn't a lot of science there, but there seems to be a link. I think there is a lot of science between meditation and creativity, if I'm not incorrect
right.
on that.
I don't know that literature that well. I've studied it, and we talk about it a little bit in the creativity chapter at the end of the book. But this thing that you're talking about, meditation in motion, is exactly right. And when hatha yoga is done right, at least by my lights, you're concentrating on your body, and you are in a kind of meditative state. And it's not Bikram with mirrors and all these things that are drawing you outward into this competitive frame of mind. In a way, you are focusing inward and paying very close attention to pain, to sensation, to the proprioceptive information that's flooding your brain. And that, I think, is meditative. I think that's the kind of thing that does this right brain activation. The psychologists call it a gestalt. A lot of the body perception that we do is a gestalt kind of thing, where you're taking in a lot of little bits of information and making a whole out of it. That happens a lot when yoga is done right, and I think you're exactly right, can be meditation in motion. There haven't been studies done on that that I'm aware of, all the evidence points in that direction.
Am I inferring correctly that you've not found a lot to like about Bikram yoga?
You know, I don't want to badmouth it, right? I have admiration for the guy, and I think for many individuals it can be a good thing. I did a book signing on Saturday, and this wonderful old gentleman came up who has been doing Bikram for 3 years, and he loves it, and he looked terrific. He had to have been 68 years old, and he just looked like he was in fabulous shape. He said he did it all the time because it was right next door to where he lived, and he shone like a light bulb, right? So I think Bikram can be a good thing for many people, but it has a downside, that kind of flexibility and ease that you can get from all the heat can also create wobbly joints. That's what physicians worry about, joint destabilization, so that you can injure yourself, so that you can have dislocations or sprains of joints more readily than you would otherwise. So like a lot of this stuff, you have to be careful and smart about it. But I think for some people, Bikram is exactly right. And I know people get addicted to it. It becomes a lifestyle.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Chris on the line in Dallas. Hello, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I was just calling. There is a style for that lady that was asking about yoga. I'm a practicing yogi, just got my certification, and she could look up Vini yoga. That would help her. And then for the 10-year-old, Ashtanga was created for 12-year-olds.
Huh, interesting.
I was
not aware of that. And Vini yoga does have a great reputation for gentleness and for a slow, easy start on all these things and sensitivity. So maybe that is the right way to go.
What is your sense, Bill, of the kind of study that is still needed as we seek to understand how yoga works and what it can and cannot do for us?
Well, after doing all this research, I have two really big questions that I would love to see serious scientists wrestle with. And they are extreme questions. And they are, one, how low can we go? How low can the human metabolism be ramped down and still have a person be alive. The evidence in some ways points to extreme states that we would call suspended animation, where individuals are basically stopped, almost dead, but they're still alive, and they can come back alive out of these states.
You've got this crazy story in the book.
Right. The 40-day burial, the Punjab yogi at the court of Ranjit Singh, who gets buried, it seems like all the evidence suggests, for 40 days and 40 nights, and he comes back alive. It's just this wonderful, it was a great thing to write about because it's so dramatic. You know, his skin is all cold and wrinkled, and you think that he's a goner, and then all of a sudden, little by little, this guy comes back to life, and then he looks at the, Ranjit Singh, the king of the Punjab, and says, "Do you believe me now?" So I think that's a serious question. And at the other end of the spectrum, another serious question, which to me is mind-blowing, is how high can you go? There, one of the wild chapters in the book is divine sex. And it's clear that certain yoga poses are sexually arousing. Now, some of the evidence suggests that yogis can enter intense states of sexual arousal that last. Basically, that you have what you've got to call, on the physical level, an extended orgasm. Some really, really good sexual pleasure that continues. Maybe it's ecstatic bliss. Maybe it's spiritual. I don't know what it is, but the evidence is suggestive. It's not ironclad, but it's suggestive that people can do this to themselves. For instance, Rutgers University right today is doing brain scanning on women who can do what the Rutgers people call thinking off. Clinically, it's called spontaneous orgasm, but their brains light up in ways that are characteristic of lovers who are, at the peak of sexual pleasure. What's going on there? How long can it last? Is this a normal state that humans can put themselves into? Is it good? Does it make us better people? Is it something we should all aspire to, or is it just for crazy people or prophets or, religious aesthetics or what? There's all kinds of questions tied up in that, and some of them can be addressed by science.
Well, with that built up,
on that wild note,
what do you suggest to people who maybe haven't tried it or haven't done it in 20 years? Do you start with a DVD? Do you walk into a studio and find something for beginners?
I would say it's always better to start with a good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
DVDs are great, but you don't get that custom approach. And get an experienced teacher. Start out with a gentle style. See what works. See what doesn't. And I would encourage older people to try it. Just, you're starting to see the science come in. And this is totally logical, but just think of the implications. Yoga helps you with your balance. Many yoga poses are balance-related. But just think about the number of elder people who hurt themselves badly in falls, right? And who then end up in the hospital for surgery and pick up an infection and die. I could see yoga being taught in senior homes and in assisted living places so that it's not only a good thing socially for seniors, but it also helps them navigate and keeps them on their feet rather than toppling over and doing serious damage to themselves.
The new book by William J. Broad is The Science of Yoga, The Risks and the Rewards. Bill, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Chris, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Senior producer is Jeff Whittington. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email them to think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.